Big ol' Marcus.
Oh, dude.
Big ol' Marcus.
Right here.
Welcome back to the Native Ways Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Ellis.
I'm your co-host, Christian Miller.
And today we got a pretty neat guest with us, Gene Tolbert, here at GT's Digs.
What's up, diggers?
But before we get into it, Christian's going to go through the announcements.
Yeah, so make sure you keep following us on all our socials. You can find us at Native Ways Podcast on pretty much everything. Shout out to Dancing Dogs Ranch again. Appreciate your support. Also, Texas Cash. If you will, we do have an upcoming announcement. We will be at the Temple Artifact Show June 6th through the 8th. So if y'all want to come out, check us out. We'll be there. But other than that, go ahead.
We'll be there set up. We'll have a whole podcast booth going. We'll be running some live stuff. So if y'all want to swing through, we'll be doing live recordings. We'll have some giveaway stuff going on there too. Get to see Texas Cash and anybody else that's associated with us. I know Cole will be there selling shrimp rakes, some tables, things like that. So we'll have some cool stuff going on. Yeah. Christian, you want to introduce Gene? Or?
Yeah, so, special guest, pretty well-known guy in the community, I would say. Gene Tolbert, also known as GT. We're here today at his place. Gene, if you want to just give us an overview about yourself, a little bio.
Yeah, well, I wasn't always interested in artifacts, man. You know, I bought a place in Elgin, only 4.3 acres. You know, my son started finding little flakes here and there, posted on the internet, and boom, I got interested and literally sold all my hot rods, and that's what I wanted to do, man. You know, so here I am. Now we're, I think, four sites in, maybe five, and still on this site, the Hawkeye, since 2020.
Man, that's awesome. So I guess what really got you started into the community? What got you looking for artifacts?
As I said, my original site, I'm sure a lot of my original customers will remember that site. It's 4.3 acres, and my son's go-kart was basically a little track going around our 4.3 acres, and it started spitting up some flint and found, I think, the first point we found was a little Darrell point, you know, maybe about this big. And we had found stuff on my dad's ranch about 20 miles from my original site. But that's mainly on the surface, man. I was probably collecting 4 years prior to finding my first artifact in the sand, because it was all surface on the clay on a 40-acre ranch. And everything I did find, we gave to my father and my mother, and we just all community collected there. You know, I didn't actually have my own collection at that point. You can see a couple of up here, these big ones that are on the actual wall, those were all from my ranch.
Really?
Once I really got into it was, again, my original site.
Heck yeah. So your original site, so you basically started finding them because your son's go-kart tracks, stuff.
Absolutely,
like that?
Absolutely, yeah. I had no idea what a Darrell was. When I found stuff at my dad's ranch, it was broken to pieces, man. We were using a backhoe to literally back drag on the, and then checking it after the rain. And we were stoked to find a broken piece.
Yeah.
You know?
Christian's right. First hole point was a little Darrell, kind of probably like what you're talking about from the raised dig.
In the sand.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah. So started out with a go-kart track. So at what point or what got you into looking at the pay dig side of it or public dig side of it? I know, you know, you probably started out private digging it, I'm assuming.
Yes, absolutely. So once I started posting a few points, I had basically went into the Texas Chert group, and I had seen Clint Beckham and Nacho. Nacho was one of the first pay digs I ever seen on the internet, just killing it, man. And that made me want to go do something. I wanted to go to his dig. I think he shut down pretty quick after I got involved. And then I went to a few of Clint Beckham's digs, and I fell in love, man. I ended up selling my hot rods, buying a Kubota. Actually, it was it was a case skid steer at that point. So that was the start of just going hog wild on it. we did a lot of shaking with my original shaker table with just friends, man. You know, first probably 3 months, it was hand digging, had a swimming pool in the back. Basically, we dug. and my wife was, at the time, my fiance was getting upset. We were out there for 10, 12 hours a day digging, hand digging, you know. And then that's when we went ahead and decided we needed to do something and make it into a some kind of way to continue to dig without spending a ton of money and resources on doing it. So that's kind of how it inspired me to build tables or, you know, whatnot. Then I saw the community, the artifact community, how much they loved finding these points, especially these points in sand. You know, the sand points, you can see them. If you've got a sand point in another collection that's from the hill country or anywhere else, you can pretty much see that sand polish.
Yeah.
You know, and just love it.
Yeah. Heck yeah. That's crazy. So it started with the go-kart track, then turned to digging a swimming pool.
Yeah.
Which is honestly pretty wild. I've got some friends there close to where we're at, and we went down there fishing on their property one time. And I had never thought about talking to them about digging or anything. Went out there to fish, and they were having their pool, some pool work done.
Yeah.
Pull up, and I see all the tailings from digging out this pool, and it's just solid black camp dirt. And I was like, golly. So then I talked to them about digging it. Anyway, they'd already leased it out, but that's crazy. So basically, you started public digging as a form almost to feed the hobby.
Yeah, basically, almost to feed the hobby, you know. At that point, I think I built at first 5 tables running 10 people per day, only on the weekends. I was still doing my construction, as I do still to this day. I've never quit my original job doing construction. I am pretty lenient on my hours there, so I can build this company and do what I need to do. So that is, I'm very fortunate in that aspect.
Yeah. And so the original site, I mean, I'm pretty familiar with it. I never dug there. About the time, honestly, you kind of got into this about the same time as me. I started digging, I think, in 2015 when I was still in high school. So I didn't have money to afford pay digging and stuff when I was finishing high school, going into college. Now I do. So now I get to go and do them every now and then. But, so what, I mean, I got to see a lot of the stuff that was coming out of your original site just through Texas Pay Digs, Texas Chert, all that stuff.
Right.
What were some of the significant finds and some of the stuff that really stuck out to you? What were y'all finding and some of the really impressive pieces?
Man, I mean, I know probably going to laugh at me, but the Darl points that came out of that site, mainly the blades. There was Friday blades and Darl blades just dang near every Friday we found a Friday blade. It was kind of funny, you know, just really, really comical.
Right.
But the blades, man, that's mainly what we didn't find a whole lot of paleo there. Golondrina here and there, you know, maybe one or two St. Mary's halls here and there, but it was mainly archaics and Darls, and it was loaded with those. And they were the quality of a Darl point. Everybody knows that knows digging, the quality of the Darl points are just great.
Yeah.
So that really made my customers really happy and my collectors really happy to be able to find the quantity and the quality at that camp.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody likes a good blade.
Good blade, good points. That's the thing. So we recently did an episode kind of catering to, you know, first-time pay diggers or stuff like that, that explained, like, when you're looking at a pay dig site to go to, quality versus quantity, or when you can find the best of both worlds. And those are the camps that everybody wants to be in, is one of those that's
absolutely
got both quantity and quality.
Right.
So that's cool. Yeah. Here.
You know, it's always better to be at a camp that's new. The newer camps, man, by all means, go there, get you at least 2 days, because any camp and every camp is always different. You never know what you're going to get.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you're saying too, so I don't know what it is about these sand camps, and maybe you can kind of tell us. You know, we're from, I guess you could consider it closer to the hill country, you know, that black dirt type camp.
Yeah, absolutely.
More midden type camps, shell midden, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
These sand camps seem to produce more paleo pieces, and I don't know, maybe it's a misconception, maybe people aren't digging deep enough in our area, I don't know, but it seems like this area, the paleo is a lot hotter, there's a lot more St. Mary's Halls, and Golondrina's coming out. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I've noticed that, but I think the sand camps are more forgiving, and, you know, we know we can go down to a clay bottom. Usually a sand camp is 3 to 10 foot deep, and these skid steers can get down to 10 foot easy.
Yeah.
You know, midden dirt, you're going to be seeing a lot of different color change, and there's going to be a lot of sterile dirt in between. Not saying there's not sterile dirt in the sand. Don't get me wrong. We go through some days where I'm just like, man, do I still need to do this? But,
right.
You know, we're always looking for a new sand camp. Just the hill country, man, that I think it's just y'all, we're not getting deep enough.
Yeah.
We don't understand the layers enough. You know, I believe there's a lot of paleo all over Texas. But it's just easier to get to.
A lot easier than sand, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense. And, like, you know, we'll dig camps around home, and there's a lot of false layers, which I'm sure there are in sand camps, too.
Absolutely. But
there's a lot of false, you know, gravel layers and sedimentation layers just from... Mm-hmm. settlement over time from creeks rising, stuff washing off tops, things like that. So
yeah, you gotta think about it. We're digging stuff that's 1200 years old to 13,000 years ago. Yeah. So there, how many layers of just rain and bad weather and wind blew all that sand on top of this stuff, or washes that, or even just other cultures that just stacked more midden and more midden and more midden on top of stuff. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
So that midden wasn't always burning. Those middens are always moved. You know, they stack stuff on top of them. You don't even know they're there, really. You know, some of the cultures, some of them are so deep that you would never see them unless you dig.
Yeah. Yeah. So your original site was basically your backyard, and
still is.
Yeah. And got you into this and made you want to pay dig.
Made me want to collect, and the pay digging helped that aspect.
Definitely. Yeah. Sorry. I kind of misworded that.
No worries.
And a lot of operators that run pay digs are also collectors. I mean, some of the best collections you'll see are guys that do it Absolutely. As much as y'all do. I mean, clearly always looking for sites, just like most people that do collect, but you know, having the opportunity to go and see sites and actually get in the dirt a lot more.
Yeah.
Y'all have some pretty amazing collections. I mean, everybody I know that personally runs pay digs has awesome collections. But that being said, what are the services you offer at GT's Digs?
Well, we offer the shaker table. The hand digging is actually discontinued until we find a new site. We're always looking. I've got a few irons in the fire right now that we're supposed to go check out. You know, I forgot what we're saying.
Oh, just what you offer. You're good.
Yeah, offering. Sorry. So we offer a shaker table and hand dig and surface hunt at the Hog Eye right now. We also offer a land owner evaluation. So if you do have a creek, a river, spring, and some hills on your property, and you're interested in finding out if you have any artifacts or a native camp on your property, we will come out and we can confirm how big it is, how deep it is, and go from there. We love to have landowner opportunities come up for pay digs, obviously, and pay digging for the landowner can earn them a lot of money at the end of the year. Landowners don't have to do much. you know, other than give us a signed paperwork saying that we're allowed to dig there. We are fully operational with insurance. We're a full-on company, so you know all of the landowners that we deal with are have a umbrella covered over all of us. So there is that.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you haven't been on a pay dig, majority of operators that do it correctly, they'll have liability forms that you fill out at the start of the dig and all that stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
To take the liability off of the landowner if anything was to happen, which very seldomly do things happen, but things do happen. It's digging. It's not necessarily the safest thing at times, but you know, takes liability off the home, the landowner, and lets them get people out there and put some points on tables and some money in pockets.
So yes,
that's cool. So after your original site, what did you kind of do after that? Like, where'd you go?
So I dug the original site for 2.5 years with 10 people every weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Once that kind of slowed down, we were actually, I think, in an off period for several months. Then we got the opportunity to open up Maggie Wendell's place. We were the first operations out there, found some good stuff out there. She's still running a pay dig that I know of out there. Then we moved on from there and went to, I believe, Sage Ranch, which is right here in Elgin. It was more my style, you know, the sand that I love. We dug that. It was real hard to get traction there at the Sage Ranch. You know, we were trying to get 10 people there every weekend. We were struggling to get 5, 4, you know, landowners, they can't make any money on 5, 4 people. We were finding stuff, but it was mainly paleo, and we had to dig literally through clay and rock to get to the actual paleo and stuff. At that point, we dug probably 15% of that camp or less and had to back out because it just, unless we get enough traction, you know, the camps are just not going to be worth the landowner's while or our while, you know. We're here to save as many artifacts as we can, and if the artifacts aren't coming out, man, it's hard to really see us going back there for our customers.
Absolutely. So after the Sage site, what'd you do? I mean, it sounds like what your priority is to put out the best camp possible for a customer and the landowner opportunity as well. And if it's not doing that, then
absolutely. I think right after Sage Ranch was the Blue Sand Pit.
Yeah, I think is what you called it.
Yeah,
that's where the Cibolo blade is. That where?
Yeah, that's where the Cibolo blade and the actual bone handle came out that Ray Gilligan owns. That was Ray Gilligan's original site. That is where Ray actually got his name. You know, I helped him open that camp up very proudly. He took it and ran, man.
Yep.
He's done just as good as me, if not better, man. He's well known in the artifact community just as fast as I was. You know, when I first got into the artifact community, all I kept saying is, I want to get my name out there. I want to get my name out there. And that man got his name out there just as quick as I did, you know.
Yeah. Ray's a great dude. We've dug with Ray. I've dug with Ray twice now. First time was Ann's Hill, and I found like a 4 1/4, I say like a 4 1/4 inch Yewa knife, and it's fantastic. Then we went to his last dig, Ray, what was that one called?
Twin Creeks.
Yeah. And we dug there, and that camp was good. It was a little slower than Ann's Hill was, but, I mean, some crazy stuff come out of there, all the Scott's Bluff.
Should have called it Scotty Hill, man.
Yeah, for real. Crazy. That Scott's Bluff drill Dustin found out there.
Nuts.
Just insane pieces.
And to get it caught on the dang...
on the drone.
On the drone. That was epic, man. Love it.
Yeah.
You know, Ray really has stepped up and helped us out a lot. I want to shout out Ray and Gilligan's Pay Dig, his wife. They are awesome. Anytime I need something, he's right around the corner, man. Like, yeah, whether he's doing something or not, that man will jump and help. Yeah. And
good dude.
We try to do the same for him.
We've talked about Ray on previous episodes when his, I mean, and I'm not saying that he does this all the time, but we've been to digs when they get a little slower, he'll throw you on the shaker for a minute. I mean, he wants people to find points and he wants, mm-hmm, you to leave there happy. He also makes custom cases, Yewall Woodwork, so y'all can check that out too. But so then, you know, you and Ray kind of started things up together. You kind of helped get him going.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I seen him just like I was, man. You know, he was posting on Facebook, hey, what is this? And finding red ochre, and I could tell in his pictures there was sand. Oh, man, I love the sand. I was just green pretty much still, maybe a year into it at my place. Year and a half. No, it was 2 years.
Yeah.
But needless to say, he allowed me to come over there, invited me with open arms, and I pretty much showed him, go to the clay, man, go to the clay. He was actually he was running a E35 excavator, you know, just with the arm that'll reach real deep, you know. So I was definitely recommending track, steer, and actually going to the clay. I brought my machine out there several times. And even at that time, he was maybe a month into it, and he was already trying to build a shaker, you know?
So, yeah, when it gets a hold of you, it gets you. It's crazy.
So I see that you had the nickname of Sandman. Is that right?
Not really, man. I mean, I guess I've been known as the Sandman, but honestly, here in Bastrop County, there was an old man that was here. He was one of the original Shaker Table Sandmen here, and he literally had the name Sandman.
Really?
So okay. I don't want to take that from an old
school. Yeah, gotcha.
I am GT.
Yes, sir.
We'd seen it on I guess it might have been one of your YouTube videos. I don't know. But in the description, it said the Sandman or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Which I had never heard anybody call you that.
But yeah.
I've always known you as GT. But then from there, so after Ray's, where'd you go? Is that here? Is that the next site?
Yeah, I believe so.
So here at the Hall Guy?
I believe so. I think we did, of course, test 3-4 places, but none of them really panned out. Until we got the Hog Eye. Once we got the Hog Eye, it was a pretty rough start.
Yeah.
I don't know if everybody knows, but I purchased this property, and with the contingency of being able to test dig it for 2 weeks. And I probably shouldn't say this. I already kind of knew there was artifacts here, so I had customers out here. Cops got called, and apparently I wasn't supposed to have customers, and they literally raised the price on me about $70,000 on this property.
Holy
crap. Order for me to get it. And they held my machines, my rental machines, 2 rental machines and 20 tables in here for a month.
Daggum.
Daggum. They stuck it to
you.
It
was a rough start, wasn't
it? Yeah. Yeah, and at that point, man, my wife was helping me book at that point. She had like a month and a half of bookings all the way down. And then we had to tell everybody, hey, we got to wait a month.
Canceled.
Canceled. I'm sorry.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, yeah, we're sitting here at the Hall Guy. We're in Gene's museum. He's got merch in here, hats, shirts. I think he sells shrimp rakes, stuff like that too, yeah?
Yes, sir. Cases, shrimp rakes, hats, some artifacts here and there.
Lots of artifacts. But yeah. This site, I mean, I personally, I'd never heard of it until you purchased it, but apparently it's a very well-known site in your area for this reason.
Yeah, so before we purchased this site, we actually, a banker, one of my dad's friends, said, hey, man, I heard that there's a site for, or a land for sale that they found artifacts on. It's actually owned by the Brickyard. And I talked to Charlie Lutton, and at that point we were talking quite a bit because he was coming out to my original site, you know, the first 2 years we were there quite often. And he basically told me, hey, dude, that that's the Hawkeye Clovis Cache site. And I was like, no, that's not. I figured it was like, you know, on the other side of the fence kind of deal.
Yeah.
Like, I'm close to it, bro, but I'm not there.
Yeah.
You know, upon further research, buying the book, calling other people, figuring out that it is the site. I literally, once I found that out, I actually did that picture right there, right behind you.
Yeah.
There's a picture in the book, actually, that the archaeologists from A&M were standing by a throw pile from the brickyard. They had quarried from the actual wall, and they turned around and put it in a pile in order for the dump trucks to come take it to the plant to sift it and put it into the bricks. Well, they found that cache in the buckets, so that's when they called the A&M. A&M came out here and started doing some digging on those piles that they said, hey, the cache was from this pile and we piled it here. Well, I actually have a picture of the same exact tree in the background next to the pile with me pointing at the tree in the background. So when I got this place, that pile was still there. They had done a lot of digging through it. I didn't find anything in it other than like a broke paleo, not a Clovis. I think when Justin Whitworth was out here with his machine and shaker, we dug that pile and didn't really find much. So they did a pretty thorough job digging that.
They got them. So what was the Hawkeye Clovis cache, for those that don't know?
So the Hawkeye Clovis cache was a 52-blade cache that was found in the 90s, I believe. Maybe Oath. I always get it mixed, 93 or 03. I don't know. Anyway, if I read the book again, I could tell you. But I believe it was bifaces mostly, but there were some significant Clovises in there. 5 inches or more, absolutely perfect. Some of the best Clovises I've seen. I've only seen maybe two since I've owned the place to be that quality. And none of them were as big.
Yeah.
You know, the Clovis cache that was found here before me was a huge deal. That ended up being the biggest Clovis cache in North America, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
One of, at least.
Yeah.
Now that Brad Agnew has found the Clovis bladelet cache of 72, I think that beats it a little bit.
Just a little.
Yeah, hand dug at that.
Yeah,
right.
If y'all want to see that, he has a YouTube. I think it's called Curious Archaeology.
Absolutely.
And he's got a video of that. And I think David Callum came out here and helped excavate it as well.
Yeah. So David and his crew came out here and did 3 core samples. So when I say a core sample, it's literally they take a piece of pipe that's about 3 inches. In diameter and cut it in 1 foot sections. And what they do is they hammer that core into where the Clovis blades had came out of. We didn't dig any further than the blades. We still had indentions of where that blade came out, where that last blade came out. So you do 3 cores, 1 straight down and 2 into the wall sideways, you know. And that actually makes it to where the soil sample is not exposed to the elements. So then they can get it and actually do their science. I don't know all that is.
Yeah.
But, you know, try to figure out dating on those blades. Of course, Clovis technology is definitely something that you can really tell. You know, we're 98% sure that that's what they are.
Yeah.
But you know, it's always nice to know an exact date, you know, rather than 12,000 years or 13,000 years. You know, they can get it down to a couple, you know, decades.
So we talked about, you know, you getting this property, knowing that there's artifacts here prior whenever you're going to purchase it. So what was your vision moving forward from there?
Man, really just finding and saving as many artifacts as we could. The first year I did quite a bit of collecting myself. The second year, I focused on strictly trying to allow my customers to find the artifacts rather than me. I love the artifacts just as much as you guys do, man, but seeing you guys find them is just as appealing and fun to me as it is finding them myself.
Absolutely.
So being able to say that artifact that you found came from my site is just as rewarding as you saying you found it at my site.
Yeah. I've tried to explain that to Christian. I mean, he digs with me now and stuff, mm-hmm. and he's newer to digging, but seeing other people find it, in my opinion, I mean, if I know you or whatever, I'm going to be just as excited for you.
Absolutely.
As I am if I find one. It's...
Yeah, it's like getting into a new hobby, you know, and you have a passion and love for it, and seeing, you know, like somebody's kids learning it, or even like... Yeah. You know, first time taking someone digging like you did me, and me taking you duck hunting for the first time, stuff like that. That's like some of the best times you could have right there, is absolutely. seeing somebody feel something like joy or yeah. happiness. You know, absolutely. it's just an infectious feeling.
Yeah, and getting to uncover the artifacts like y'all have found at this site. I know that this site is quite a bit larger than your original site.
Yeah, man, I was actually overwhelmed when I got this site. I only had 4.3 acres at my original site. And we ran that for 2.5 years with 10 customers per day every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Man, when I got this site, saw how big it was, the depth of it, I built 10 more tables. At that point, I only had 5. You know, that put us up to 15 tables. To start this camp, we didn't have the shaker table. We hadn't implemented the shaker table, the Ray Gilligan shaker table. I think within maybe 2.5 years of owning the place, that's when we implemented that. The amount of excitement. With 15 people, with 15 tables going, you know, and 2 skid steers. At one point, we were running 3 skid steers here, man.
Jeez.
You know, those days are just epic for me. Just memories of, oh my God, I got one. And then, oh my God, I got one. And then, oh my God, I got one. You know, just everybody just gathering around one table mm-hmm. is just that gets you that excitement, you know.
That's... It's really special when you're on sites like that and when you get to experience it. I've never seen a dig run with 3. I've seen 2. I don't know if you ever got to go to Tanner's dig on Twin Elm, but that dig, he had 2 machines every time I went, and that was one of those. It was just boom, 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 just artifact
the,
here.
Yes,
and just killer
the excitement
after killer.
Of everybody finding good stuff.
And it keeps not only the operators going, but it keeps the excitement with the customers. So, I mean, it's... You're just, you know, like every few minutes something's going to hit and it's going to be, okay, what are we looking at now?
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing. It's just the mystery behind everything. Like that's what fuels everyone.
You never know what you're going to find. And I'm glad you mentioned the operators, man. These operators that work for these digs, man, they're beasts.
Oh, yeah.
They suffer through some of the heat and... exposure to so much just dust and nastiness, and then if it's a slow day, man, my operators and any operator can tell you, your tail is tucked between your legs, just mm-hmm. hoping something really good's gonna come out for somebody. You know, it's that's what it's all about. If it's slow, you're gonna be in your head, man. Yeah. My operators get in their head all the time if they're not finding anything. You know, and I got to tell them, you know, when we're digging lines. We know that a bucket hasn't been there. You know, we can see sediment lines. I call it the birthday cake lines. It looks like a 15-layer cake in the sand. It's that obvious. Every 6 inches, you see a dark sediment line, only a quarter inch thick, and then another dark sediment line 6 inches lower. And we know we're in good dirt. But it's not that good dirt because you never know what you're going to find.
Yeah, absolutely.
We know it's not been dug, but we don't know what's going to come out of it.
And we've talked about that in other episodes. Mm-hmm. So if this is your first time listening, you know, these operators, just like he just said, I mean, they put in a ton of work. These guys like to find arrowheads too, but they're spending their time to put these points out for you. And I mean, I've been in the position just with the digs that we run privately, you know, when we're in a slower section of the day, it does get in your head, and you know, you're wanting people to find stuff and wanting people to find stuff. So I know for a fact that's how your operators feel when you do hit a slow pocket, because
absolutely,
you've got all these people depending on you essentially, yeah, to make it happen. And a lot of people take that for granted. I've seen reviews that people have left on other operators because they had a slow day at a camp. It's not like that. It's not, you're not paying to find, you're paying to get the access and have the opportunity. So y'all should appreciate, yeah, that. Appreciate the operators. I always try to tell people, you know, it's a lot of work. They earn a tip even too, in my opinion.
Yes, absolutely. I believe our operators should make more than us pay diggers, man. They work hard.
Yeah.
They're out there in the elements constantly. You know, they worked on a fixed income on each day. We pay them a set amount. So the tips really, really help out with these operators.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the more you get to know an operator too, like I'm good friends with a handful of operators, and it helps to form a relationship with them too. But you know, they're putting in a lot of effort for you as a paying customer. So you should also appreciate that. I mean, I've never been to a dig where I left unhappy, even if I've had a slow day. Because I know the effort was put in. I've never had a bad day digging.
Yeah. It's not like they make a metal detector for a full point or flint, you know, right. It's not like you can just go and be like, it's right there, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, just pull a bucket out and it'd be there. So,
and
you just have to get through it.
Even when it's slow too, y'all still have to stay motivated to keep digging through that stuff, because, and I'm really big on this, dig the whole camp out, dig through, you got to dig through, absolutely, the slow to find the best pieces sometimes.
I mean, absolutely.
If you skip around to what looks the hottest to you, you're going to miss some of the best parts of the camp just because you wanted to get out of that slow spot.
Absolutely.
Dig through the slow spot and you're going to hit another one. That being said, I know this camp's been extremely hot, and I know I've seen a lot of artifacts come from here. I've only personally dug here once and we hand dug. I missed out on a lot of opportunities in the earlier years of you running it, but there's been some extremely significant finds here. So you want to kind of talk about some of those?
Yeah. The one that really sticks out is the infamous boomerang thing. It was, when it was posted, man, there was a lot of hate. I mean, a lot of people didn't think it was real. You know, within the first 30 minutes of that coming out of the soil, Carlos, he said, hey, send me a picture of it after the color change. I know that thing's going to change colors. And within 10 minutes of his comment, I sent him another picture, and he said, oh my God, because the patina is obviously one side versus the other is exactly what you want to see,
yeah,
mm-hmm, on an artifact like that. Being that it is so rare and so unique, I don't blame everybody that did question the artifact. That's what we're here for, man. We don't want modern pieces getting into the collections of high-end collections or even low-end collections, because eventually those low-end collections will either be given to somebody that's going to sell them to somebody that doesn't know, or it's just going to taint a big collection, and nobody, yeah, wants that.
Yeah.
So with that being said, I did get two COAs on it within the first, I think, 2 weeks of owning that, because I did purchase it from the finder. I was very fortunate that the hand digger that found it was willing to sell it to me at a reasonable price. And she dug here probably 8 times free, plus got a good chunk of change. So
I can only imagine.
She was super happy. The eccentrics and the obsidian, you know, a lot of people say that stuff here that come out of here that shouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
And to an extent, I kind of agree with you. But with the vast trade resources that these camps had and these creeks had, you know, that it doesn't surprise me that we find stuff that, like the obsidian. I've got a paper here that says it's from Mallet, Idaho. We found it 6 foot deep in a sand camp in Texas. You know, that just blows my mind how resourceful these cultures were for thousands of years.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about that. I know I've referenced other episodes a few times in this episode, but it's because we're bringing up points that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, I think typology is almost a crutch because people look at the distribution areas and they're like, oh, this point can only be like Big Sandy's. I know that y'all are finding some here. Yeah, I know absolutely. Ray's found some. That's not a type that's supposed to be here.
Right.
But neither is that obsidian from Idaho.
Right.
It got here for a reason. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those points have a distribution zone for a reason. They do travel. That doesn't mean that everything's going to be found within those areas.
So I did mention patina on one side. I like to talk about that. On these artifacts that we find here in the sand camps, man, you know, I'm not saying this because I learned it in a book, okay? This is just me experiencing artifacts coming out of the ground, out of the sand, and the way they're positioned in the sand and where the patina is on that artifact. Where do you think the patina would be? Top side or bottom side?
In a sand camp?
In a sand camp.
Well, I'm going to say, because you should expect it to be on top, I'm going to say it's going to be on the bottom.
You'd be correct if you're on the top.
Okay.
Okay. So if you think about it, when an artifact is sitting on the surface and it gets buried and it gets buried and it gets buried, all that rain is coming down, all the elements from the top is coming down, seeping through the sand, and all of that material from the sand is actually what patinas
deposits on the top.
Yeah. So when we find these artifacts hand digging, we pull them out of the sand. I don't know if you've noticed, but in a lot of these videos, you'll see the sand is stuck to the top and just nothing on the bottom.
Hmm.
So that's because of the elements, and the wetness is turning that into some kind of sticky
concentration
that just sat on that exact surface for that long to create that patina.
That's cool. We've never dived into that, and definitely not relating to sand camps. I mean, I know the midden camps that we dig and stuff, you do expect it on the top. Mm-hmm. A lot of people relate it to the sun, things like that. Never really tied in what deposits on top of it in the soil.
Yeah, so a lot of the mineral deposits is what I think. I'm not, like I said, I'm not reading this in a book. This is just what I've noticed and how I kind of put it together in my mind. It may not be true, but
that makes total sense.
As far as I can tell, everything that I've seen pulled out, there's sand stuck on the top, and that sand that's stuck on the top, when you clean it off, that is the patina side.
It makes total sense. Do you mind kind of talking about that point? Has there been any research done on it or anything? What do they think it was used for?
It's really hard to say, man. You know, Carlos put it under microscope when I first actually got it looked at, and it was hard for him to really tell how it was used. It may not have been used hardly at all before something happened to the native that made it. There usually, if it was used for meat or used for plant matter, you would see some kind of really high polish. You know, not just the sand camp polish you see all over the points that we see here. More of a smooth to the touch polish, if you will. I've always, you know, when you're holding it in your hand, it feels like it'd be a weapon to maybe scalp somebody, or maybe a used tool to skin an animal, like a hide on your thigh. It fits perfect on your thigh. The shape of it on the backbone, if you will, is thick on the back curve where the tang is.
Like you apply pressure.
Right. Like it's going to be thicker and harder to break. Now in the curve on the middle, on the inside, it is sharpened and almost serrated, like it was made to cut something. So you could almost say it was used to cut plants down, but there's not plant matter. You could almost say it was used to skin animal skin, but there's no real rub marks on it. So was it used as a decoration, like on top of a staff? I am chief,
like Ren's,
you know,
like
yeah,
Ren's rendering of
exactly
it.
Like Ren's rendering of it right behind me here. I don't know if y'all can see me. That is also another question. When Ren was going to do that drawing and asked me if she could do that painting, she asked me how I would think that it was possibly used. And I really couldn't answer that, man. Because I see so many ways that this thing could have been used. Mm-hmm. Like, I mentioned that I'd like her to do another painting, honestly, of, I don't know if you can imagine a little bit bigger painting with a little boy holding this thing and it being on his chest as a piece, and then that same little boy as a teenager, and it you know, on his wrist as you know, something to really utilize, and then later on him as chief, and it's on a staff, and he's just like, yeah, I am staff,
as
I am
grown.
Chief. Yeah, you know, as he grew, he used it in several different areas, several different parts of his life for several different things.
Yeah,
and that's what I see in it.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of those Alaskan Ulu knives.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of like backwards.
Yeah,
it's insane.
And that's the thing, is there are other artifacts like this, mm-hmm. but they're made backwards.
The other way.
Yeah. The other way. Mm-hmm. The actual hafting point on this one is on the backbone of it, not on the inside. Mm-hmm.
Is there any wear on it that suggested it was ever hafted, or did he not?
He really couldn't tell, man. I mean,
that's crazy. So that, it could have just been a first stage piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there was other people that say it could have been a big blade. That could have been the big blade that they broke in half, and then they just started
reworking crazy with it.
And went crazy with it. We don't know.
Yeah, that's sick. Way cool. I know. What was I going to say? I don't know what I was about to say. I had something. Anyways, keep on.
Foxworthy.
Yeah, let's hear about that.
So, I've been, you know, I mentioned Ray. Yep. Ray Gilligan. So that was, I think, 2018 or so. I had already written a thing that I wanted to do with either Foxworthy or Turtle Man, because I knew Turtle Man and Foxworthy both collect. So for almost a year, I had tried to get a hold of Foxworthy. I was paying money to get his info, to try to message his, you know, the guys that get him on his tours and all that. Went nowhere. I literally gave up. And it literally, Ray Gilligan and I both were like, dude, that would be so sick if Foxworthy comes out. Oh my God. And we both gave up, man. And then all of a sudden, his Foxworthy's land, what he calls himself, land manager, Glenn, he gives me a call and he's like, hey man, I'm Jeff Foxworthy's land manager. And I didn't believe him. I was like, hey, you got to like send me a picture or something. Like, I don't believe you, you know. And sure shit, man, within a matter of a month of talking to Glenn, Foxworthy had come down here. We had Justin Whitworth's table brought out for him. He killed it the first time he came down, bro. Like, absolutely killed it. So I gave him my little paper that I wanted to do a TV show out here for pay digging and whatnot, you know, have five different operators, kind of like Gold Rush, call it Flint Rush if you want to, you know, have five different operators going in several different places of Texas and several different camps. That'd and each cool. operator would be, you know, trying to get the best of the best. And then at the end of the season, the operators show what they've got and, you know, whatnot. It went more into depth where, you know, each operator had 10 people that are main customers for that show. And then they obviously have more than 10 people digging that day. So if something ridiculous comes out for a customer that's not on the show, they get to get on the show, you know. Well, he wasn't that interested at first. So he ended up taking the paperwork and kind of blah, blah, blah. Okay, cool. Oh, yeah, you mentioned my name, Allison, you know. And then literally the next time he comes out, he didn't even get out the truck before he's mentioning it. Dude, the TV show. I got four networks looking at TV show.
Really?
Right. So third time he comes out, he brings camera crew, spends $100,000 out here. Not with me, just camera crew and all of his stuff. And films a what he wants to call finds of a lifetime. I probably shouldn't have mentioned it, but it is still in the works. It's been about 6 months since I heard from him. I did mention it recently, and he said, don't give up. It takes time. So there is something that is in the works of possibly a Netflix or something series.
That would be sick.
That's awesome.
after that, he's come out two or three times since then. He hadn't really mentioned a whole lot about the show, but he did send me what he had recorded, and it's really neat, man. I can show you guys after the show.
Off camera.
But
that's awesome.
Until then, yeah.
That's so cool. Yeah, I bet he has a hoot to dig with, too.
Oh, he is, man. That brings up a Justin Whitworth. He brought a 5 or 6 inch Clovis cast, just a fake cast. And when we were really into digging with Foxworthy that day, and I think we had two skid steers going. Eric the operator was here. It was just crazy. Well, Justin literally just goes and stabs Foxworthy in the chest with it, like secretly. And as I'm dumping a bucket, Foxworthy literally jumps over the shaker table with his belly getting sawed by the shaker table like this. I thought he got hurt, man. I thought I was going to be screwed, you know? Just messed up a $200 million man, you know? So he actually was faking that he found that Clovis.
Oh, God.
So he did it so good. I jumped out of the freaking machine, like tripped over something, fell on the ground, and he literally throws it to me. And at that time, I kind of figured it wasn't real. Oh, man. So, yeah. And my dad was there. Everybody was just freaking out. And I literally yelled, Clovis! And as I'm catching it, you know.
As I'm catching it.
Yeah.
Slow motion.
Yeah. Nothing spoke to Foxworthy. It was literally Justin Whitworth just poking him in the side with it. And he knew exactly what to do. It was hilarious. That's awesome.
How I saw Jeff Foxworthy in half.
Yeah,
we did a really similar thing to my uncle. We hand dig this place in Pidcoke, and he was gonna be late to dig with us that day or something. And I had this old base tang; it didn't really mean much to me. It was passed down to me.
Yeah,
and I was like, dude, we ought to mess with him this weekend. So we get there, and it's a real shallow midden. And the reason we were gonna mess with him is he's like, don't nobody dig in my spot, blah blah blah. So. We get there, and I dig this hole straight down from the top about 8 inches in the wall.
Yeah.
And I set that base tang down in there, and then I covered it back up, and I patted it down so the dirt was really solid. Yeah. Well, he ended up not being able to come, so we took a video of me digging it out. It was like the greatest fake pull you could ever ask. And, dude, you could hear him. We called him, and I sent him the video and stuff, and he came. He was like 30 minutes away. Whatever he was doing, he canceled those plans. He comes hauling ass in there. You can hear him like the second he enters the property. And he gets there, and we're sitting there talking about it and stuff. He gets out of the truck, and he's like, let me see it. Me and my dad and Luke, we're all throwing it back and forth. And at that point, kind of the same thing, you know, tossing it around. He kind of realized, he's like, oh, they're messing with me. It was a real piece, but it was just something I didn't care about. But, yeah, I had the pull video. That was hilarious. But, I mean, that's really cool to have Jeff Foxworthy here. Is there any other significant people you've had or any other, like, super memorable moments here?
When Jeff, the first time he came out, I think the coach to the Royals was with him. Ned, I believe. Ned Yost. He's up there. I got next to him. And then everybody knows Cecil Baker, who was on the American Idol.
Yeah.
He's somewhat, you know, pretty good famous here. So those are the main two or three that I've had out.
Yeah, Cecil's a really good friend of one of the guys I dig with, Nathan Gilbert. They grew up together. They went to school together in Cameron. Cecil's a good dude. So we were talking earlier about when the site kind of started, and I mean a lot of the significant finds. I know it was really hot and heavy at first, and like you were doing some really cool things like night digs and stuff like that. You got any cool memories from that?
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, one of the first night digs I did here in the Hawkeye site was – epic. I loved it. I got the two big stand-up lights, you know, that you see on the side of the road for construction, and like four or five people brought canopies and put lights in their canopies and, you know, just did it good, you know, coolers, lights, music, all of it, man. And good points coming out. It was great.
That's awesome. Let's see, we're getting towards the end of it. I know that, and we kind of spoke about the Clovis cash earlier, but this site, it seems like, has just produced an astronomical amount of caches. It's like once a month, it seems like y'all are finding a cache.
Whether it's a hand digger or on the table, man, shaker table, we've had some pretty significant caches. That's wild. When you dump a load that has five blades or six blades in that load, and that's just, you're grabbing them off, you see the customers grabbing them off every piece of the dang table, it's a wild rush, you know. Before this podcast, I was really trying to think of how many blade caches or caches in general that we found here, man. And I mean, prior to me, I think there was four prior to me owning the property. So, I mean, we're probably in the 20s of caches that have come out here, whether it was a, you know, cache of three Cibolo blades or a cache of 72 lithic blades from Clovis, you know.
And those are all kind of widespread. There was no concentration just in one area.
It's absolutely. It was just, you never know.
That's crazy.
Actually, a cache was found this morning by Kyle, one of our hand diggers. Not a real significant cache. It was four blade cores, basically flint flakes that were stacked on top of each other with 1 6-inch blade on top of those.
Not significant, 6-inch blade. That's crazy. Yeah, and it seems, too, that one particular hand digger out here, I mean, he kills it all the time.
Charles.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people say on comments, I see it all the time, how does he find so much more than the shaker table or something like that? You know, Charles, he's here every day almost.
Yeah.
At least every weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Yeah.
And he don't post every day.
Yeah.
He's probably digging 15 to 30 hours before he finds a point, guys.
Yeah.
You know, we're averaging 1 to 2 per hour on the shaker table right now. Since we are at the end of the property, I do admit that is why we've discontinued our shaker or our regular hand tables right now. You know, the hand tables, when you have 10 hand tables out there, you got to satisfy 20 people.
Yeah.
Okay. Those 20 people are going to move almost as much as one whole shaker table day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I only have to satisfy four customers on a shaker table day.
Yeah.
I'm getting probably three quarters less money because of the shaker table. I'm just doing the shaker table. That's just a set amount of money every time we run.
Yeah.
So I'm losing money when I'm doing that rather than allowing 20 to 30 people out here at a time. But that's saving my name.
Yeah.
I want y'all to find stuff. I don't want to take your money if you're not going to find stuff.
Yeah.
I don't want to put you on this camp if you're not going to find stuff. To implement the shaker table and be able to find what we find right now is the best we're going to get right now until we find a new site.
Yeah. Yeah, and he speaks that honestly, too, because we had originally planned today to be a half a day dig along with the podcast, and he just told us straight up, he's like, man, the site's still excellent. There's still stuff to be found. Don't think to not come. But he told us, I don't know that y'all should really worry about it. Let's just do the podcast. Let's get some good footage in, talk about the site, and y'all come back another time when we hit a really hot spot.
Mm-hmm. But exactly.
And that's the thing, too. Like we talked about earlier, you never know when that hot spot's going to hit.
Bucket could be that hot spot. We don't know.
We could have been in it today, but that's the dice we rolled. But, I mean, as y'all can see, just some substantial artifacts. And I don't know, are all these from Hawkeye or some of these from your original site?
Some of them are from my original site. This one that sticks out is mainly from my original site. This is actually one of the first frames I put together.
Yeah. Mainly archaic stuff, you can tell.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Is that an Andice? Left of the blade? Left of the Friday?
No, that's a Castroville.
Is it?
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, when I found that, I couldn't tell you, man.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
It's definitely got a punch notching, but it's got that flare on the base, which threw everybody off. Everybody I posted it about it, they really couldn't tell me. Bell or Andice, but I think it's an Andice.
Yeah, it looks more Andice than Bell to me.
Yeah.
What about is this a cache?
Yes, that is a cache of five. One is a drill. The middle one is a drill. The four blades around the drill were found. I think two of them were found on one table. No, the big one was found on one table, and then we went into the same area and the other four came out on the next bucket.
That's a sick cache.
The cache of Covington blades, I believe.
Killer. That's all I've got, man. Christian, you got anything else?
No, I mean, it's just really awesome to come out here and see all the history and see, you know, your museum, the little Airbnb that you got going on. It's pretty awesome what you've done with the place since you've had it. And
appreciate it.
You know, keeping your name the way it's been is, you know, it's been awesome to see that too.
Yeah, I mean, thing that majority of people in the digging community know GT's Digs. I mean, it's a well-known name. In my opinion, you were one of the first to really promote more social media type stuff to like really get your name out versus these other guys that just kind of do it through the groups.
Yeah.
So I think it's really awesome what you've done here. Like I said, I know I haven't dug with you much, but I would like to in the future.
Awesome.
I think what you're doing is awesome, man. And I think it's great for the community. You want to kind of run through your services again and talk about what you have to offer?
Yeah. So we're actually offering $1,000, incentive to any customers that give us a lead on a site that does become a pay dig. If it does become a pay dig, I will give you $1,000 out of my pocket, and you get to dig for free.
That's a good deal.
We also, you know, we do as I said, the shaker table events, hand digging events, and land evaluations.
Heck yeah.
We sell a few artifacts here in the museum, shirts, hats, you know, you name it. A few cases also. So
awesome. We appreciate you sitting down with us. Like I said, I think it's awesome what you've done here. I think it's so cool that you've preserved the site the way you have, that you have the museum, you have artifacts from the site here. Everybody can go see his page, GT's Digs. He's got all the finds from all the sites he's been at. I know you have a YouTube. I don't think you're like super active on that.
Not anymore, unfortunately. You know, I'm more active on Facebook, and I do have a TikTok that I'm pretty active on. We've got 37,000 followers. That's pretty cool. We love what we do, man, and we plan on doing it for a long time. Whether we're gonna have this site the whole time, I don't know. We're always actively looking for a new opportunity. So
heck yeah, man, it's been great. I think, Christian.
Yeah, I mean, it's been great sitting down talking with you and about everything. But I think we're gonna wrap it up. Y'all just make sure you keep living your hobbies. See you in the next one.